Before we begin, I should mention that this entire lecture is AI generated, including the voice you're hearing. Today's episode is sponsored by Walkwise, a fictional app that maps your neighborhood's forgotten stories through your daily routes. And please remember that some details in this discussion might be inaccurate, so do check anything that matters to you. I was walking through Victoria Park in East London last Tuesday morning when something stopped me cold. It wasn't the lake or the pagoda or even the dog walkers rushing past. It was a small bronze plaque on a bench, weathered and barely legible. In memory of the suffragette meetings held in this park, 1906-1912, I'd walked past this bench dozens of times and never noticed it. The plaque was tucked away on what felt like the least significant bench in the entire park. No ceremony, no fanfare. Just these quiet words marking where women once gathered to demand the vote. I sat down and looked around. Joggers were streaming past, parents pushing buggies, teenagers on bikes. The morning felt utterly ordinary, unremarkable. But suddenly I could almost hear them. The voices of women who stood on soapboxes right here, shouting over hecklers and police warnings. The same paths I take to avoid crowds were once packed with audiences. The trees were probably smaller than maybe just saplings. The railings looked Victorian enough to be original, but the playground equipment was clearly modern. What struck me was how invisible this history had become. Not deliberately hidden exactly, but somehow absorbed into the landscape until it was just background noise. I started wondering how many other layers of history were sitting right here, unmarked and unnoticed. How many meetings, protests, celebrations, ordinary moments had played out on this exact spot? The park felt suddenly dense with time. Every path, every tree, every patch of grass was holding stories I couldn't see, but were somehow still there. I pulled out my phone and Googled Victoria Park suffragettes. The results were surprisingly sparse. A few mentioned in academic papers, some local history blogs. This seemed odd for something significant enough to merit a memorial plaque. Why was the documentation so thin? Had the meetings been that small, or had they just been forgotten? I realized I was sitting in the middle of what historians call the problem of women's history, the tendency for women's political activities to disappear from official records. Victoria Park was chosen by suffragettes precisely because it was public space, not private halls that could be denied to them, not streets where they could be easily arrested, but genuine common ground. The park had been created in the 1840s as a lung for the East End. It was meant to bring green space to working-class neighborhoods that were choking on industrial pollution. So when suffragettes gathered here in 1906, they were claiming space that had already been designated for public use. They were, in a sense, insisting on their right to be part of that public. The East End location mattered too. This wasn't Hyde Park Corner with its established tradition of soapbox speakers. This was working class territory, immigrant neighborhoods, places where political authority felt more distant. Many of the women who came to these meetings worked in local factories or ran small businesses. The suffrage movement here wasn't just about middle class ladies wanting political rights. It was about working women who understood exactly how political decisions affected their daily lives, wages, working conditions, housing, children's education. The park meetings allowed for a different kind of politics. Less formal than indoor lectures, more accessible than exclusive societies, women could bring their children, meet neighbors, combine political organizing with social connection. The suffrage cause became woven into the fabric of daily life. But outdoor meetings were also more vulnerable. Weather could cancel them, police could disperse them, hostile crowds could disrupt them. The records that survived suggest these Victoria Park gatherings were sometimes quite large, but more often intimate affairs. 20 or 30 women, maybe a few curious onlookers. What's fascinating is how the park itself shaped the politics. The open space encouraged a different style of speaking than formal halls. More conversational, more interactive. Speakers had to compete with birds, wind, passing carriages. They developed techniques for holding attention in a way that indoor orators never had to master. By 1912, the meetings had largely moved elsewhere, partly because the suffrage movement was becoming more militant, but also because public parks were becoming more regulated. The same local authorities that had once tolerated informal gatherings began requiring permits, setting restrictions on crowd sizes, designating specific areas for public speaking. This speaks to a larger pattern in how public space gets managed over time. What starts as genuinely open territory gradually becomes controlled, administered, parceled into acceptable uses. You can see this happening everywhere in London. Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park is the official designated spot for public speech, but it's also contained, marginalized, turned into a kind of tourist attraction. The suffragettes chose places like Victoria Park precisely because they weren't designated political spaces. They were claiming the right to make politics anywhere. This connects to something much broader about how social movements work. They often succeed not by following established channels, but by creating new ones. Think about how civil rights protesters used lunch counters and bus seats. Not political spaces, but everyday spaces that they transform through their presence. Or how climate activists target bridges and museums. They're insisting that the climate crisis should be addressed everywhere, not just in designated policy forums. The Victoria Park suffragettes understood something fundamental about power. It operates through the control of space. Who gets to speak where, when, to whom? By meeting in a public park, they were asserting their claim to public life itself. Not just the vote, but the right to participate in shaping public opinion. This connects to contemporary debates about digital public space too. Social media platforms have become our new public squares, but they're privately owned and algorithmically controlled. The question of who gets to speak, whose voices get amplified, whose meetings get organized is as relevant now as it was in 1900. The park also connects to broader patterns of how we commemorate women's history. That tiny plaque, easily missed, reflects how women's political contributions get acknowledged. Compare it to the monuments scattered around London celebrating male military and political leaders, massive statues, prominent locations, detailed biographical information. Women's political history gets marked with small plaques, if it gets marked at all. The message is that these contributions were smaller, less significant, more forgettable. But this is also about class. Working class political movements, regardless of gender, tend to leave fewer traces than elite political activities. The suffragettes meeting in Victoria Park weren't generating the kind of documentation that ends up in official archives. No stenographers, no newspaper coverage, no formal minutes. Their politics happened through conversations that weren't recorded, relationships that weren't formalized, organizing strategies that weren't published. This is true of most grassroots political work. It's ephemeral, social, embedded in daily life rather than separated from it. The park itself embodies this tension between formal and informal politics. It's officially managed with designated paths and opening hours and rules about what you can and can't do. But it's also genuinely public in ways that most spaces aren't anymore. You don't need to buy anything to be there. You don't need to justify your presence to anyone. This makes parks politically significant, even when nothing explicitly political is happening. They're spaces where different classes and communities encounter each other. The joggers and dog walkers and teenagers I saw that morning were participating in public life, even if they weren't thinking about it that way. They were sharing space across lines of difference, negotiating access to common resources, practicing the basic skills of living together in a diverse community. This connects to larger questions about what democracy actually requires, not just voting, but daily practice in sharing public space with people who aren't like you. The suffragettes meeting in Victoria Park were doing both kinds of democratic work, demanding formal political rights, but also practicing informal political skills, learning to speak in public, to organize events, to build coalitions, to handle disagreement and disruption. These skills don't develop automatically. They require practice, and they require spaces where that practice can happen. Parks serve this function in ways that aren't always recognized. They are informal schools for public life, places where people learn to be citizens. This is why the privatization of public space is so politically significant. When parks get sold off or commons get enclosed, we lose more than recreational opportunities. We lose the spaces where democratic culture gets cultivated, where people learn to speak up, organize, negotiate difference. The small plaque in Victoria Park marks not just historical suffragette meetings, but this larger function of public space in democratic life. Today, much political organizing happens online, but digital spaces work differently than physical ones. They can connect people across vast distances, but they don't require the same skills. You don't have to learn to project your voice over traffic noise or hold an audience's attention when they could simply walk away. You don't have to navigate the complex social dynamics of sharing physical space with people who disagree with you. This makes parks more important, not less. They're places where we can practice the embodied skills of democratic participation that digital organizing can't teach. The climate crisis makes this even more relevant. As we face environmental challenges that require unprecedented collective action, we need spaces where people can build trust and solidarity across difference. Parks provide exactly this. Places where different communities can encounter each other regularly, build familiarity, develop the social bonds that make political cooperation possible. The suffragettes understood this intuitively. They chose Victoria Park not just because it was accessible, but because it was already a place where different kinds of people came together. Their political organizing built on existing social networks, existing patterns of interaction, existing sense of shared investment in common space. This is how most successful political movements work. They don't create new communities from scratch, but build on social connections that already exist. Looking around the park that morning, I could see the potential for this kind of organizing everywhere. In the informal networks of dog walkers, the pickup football games, the parents chatting while their kids play, these might seem politically insignificant, but they're actually the foundation of political life. The social trust that makes everything else possible. The suffragettes meeting here were building on exactly these kinds of everyday relationships. Neighbors talking to neighbors, creating space for political conversation within social connection. This is what's captured in that small bronze plaque, if you know how to read it. Not just historical meetings, but a model of how democratic politics can work. Sitting on that bench, I realized I was looking at one of London's most significant political sites. Not because of any grand events, but because of its quiet, ongoing function in democratic life. The meetings that happened here over a century ago continue every day in different forms. Every conversation, every shared moment of attention to common concerns. That small plaque marks not just the past, but an invitation to recognize the political significance of the present moment. The democracy that's always happening if we know how to see it